둘, 셋, 파!
For Hey Army and fellow music fans, I'm Kayla.
And I'm Bethany, and we're the hosts of Standing BTS from the Consequence Podcast Network. We're a bi-weekly show that covers the impact and legacy of K-pop group BTS.
We mix the perfect blend of research and fangirl as we take a deep dive into lyrics during album reviews, theorize over music videos, and keep up with their current events.
No BTS topic is off limits. We welcome everyone into the conversation, whether you're a casual fan, committed ARMY, or someone who's just curious about one of the biggest music groups in the world.
Come chat with us every other Thursday with a new episode wherever podcasts are found.
Hello, and welcome to Long Time No See, the podcast. Each week, we'll be pairing two blindfolded comedians who've agreed to sit down with a mystery guest. I'll be putting them on the spot with a series of questions about their careers, lives, and opinions. Without further ado, please remove your blindfolds and introduce yourself.
Hey, I'm Michael.
Hi, Andrea.
I have to be honest with you, I am so relieved to see it's you.
Do you have any irrational fears? What's the worst fad you were into? Is there any job that you would be terrible at?
Underwater welder?
Don't say that about yourself.
Do you guys have any useless talents?
I kicked one of those delivery robots.
Got what? You kicked one?
Yelling. I kick those all the time.
They have names on them.
Good.
I can make smoke come out of my mouth with nothing.
Do it.
You want to see it?
What the f***? Are you a dragon?
Out now, Long Time No See, the podcast, season 2. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So you want to be a rock and roll star? No? Well, how about a podcast star? Well, as it turns out, there's a new all-in-one platform just for you. It's called Anchor, and it's the easiest way to make a podcast. And check this out, it's free. There's creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer, and then Anchor will distribute the podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify and Apple Podcast and, you know, everywhere else in podcast land. And what's even better, you can actually make money from your podcast. Go figure. No minimum listenership on that. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So go ahead, download the free Anchor app right now or go to anchor.fm to get started. So what are you waiting for? Podcast stardom is within your reach.
He's been shot 6 times. Halloweenies. He's been burned alive. Halloweenies. He's lost his head. Halloweenies. Michael Myers can't and won't be stopped, which is why he returns this October. In anticipation, the Consequence Podcast Network presents Halloweenies, a limited series that carves out one Halloween movie a month, leading all the way up to the October 19th release of David Gordon Green and Danny McBride's new movie. You'll get tricks. You'll get treats. You'll get Michael. Tune in for the night we came home.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Welcome to another edition of Kyle Meredith With. It's an audio interview series presented by WFPK, Independent Louisville, Consequence of Sound, and the Consequence Podcast Network. Wherever you're listening from today, I would love it if you hit the subscribe button right now. If you can give a rating and leave a review, that would be amazing as well. I'm Kyle Meredith. Today, my guest is the band Urge Overkill. We're celebrating the 25th anniversary of their Saturation LP. And I'll be talking with Nash, Kato, and the King all about the ins and outs of that LP and the time period, everything that was happening around then. Especially, by the way, around that time, they opened up for Nirvana's Nevermind tour and Pearl Jam's Versus tour. Some good stories that come out of that we discuss, their inclusion on the No Alternative compilation, and when we might expect new music from the band. It's Kyle Meredith with Urge Overkill.
This is King from Urge Overkill and Nash, right?
Yep.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Great. This is Kyle.
It's great to talk with you all. Thanks for giving me the call today.
Yeah.
Kind of jumping the old time machine for a little bit.
It's only been 25 years, right?
It's only been 25 years. But, you know, what an anniversary for such an important and great record like Saturation. I think this has been on your all's mind for this year. What was the exact date? What was the month? Because it just happened like a week ago, right?
June or something?
I think it was springtime. I'm not sure the exact date, June 19th or something.
Well, so happy.
I remember there was a huge party on the top of one of the buildings over by the metro down the street after the show. Nash, you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what the place was is now, but it's still there. But it was the top floor of some bar, and it was after the show. I remember it was early summer. June 8th was the actual date.
Let's get back in that era and everything, because you know at that point, Saturation, that was your major label debut, which, as I look back, there seemed to be a lot of attention really on that specifically too. I mean, you guys had been part of the indie scene for a long time, and that was in the era where it was like, oh no, one of our bands is being signed to the majors. Did you guys feel any of the pushback that it looks like, at least critically, was there?
Yeah, I mean, there was that rumble of sellouts and all that, but we had done our time in the trenches and, you know, on Touch and Go, and, you know, we put out like five or six records. So we were ready to make that jump, and I don't think we really, do you recall looking in the rearview mirror that much? Ed, I don't. It seemed like a logical evolution to, you know, the path we were on at the time.
It was one of those things where it's more imagined, you know. Mm-hmm. Nobody will will say to your face, oh, you guys sure were stupid to sign that huge to a huge major record deal, and now you have this, you know,
be a real
sort
band.
Of document. Yeah, you have. Well, yeah, so there was some imagined criticism there, I guess. But at the time, you know, we had done our homework, and it was legitimately a group of people working on the record who liked it, and who you know, we had a pretty good relationship before. We didn't have a lot of complaints really about the label or anything at that time. It was a time and I can't speak for everybody has a different trip through the music business, that's for sure.
They were the best label of the time, there's no doubt. And it was a great team, people, highly creative, you know, smart people. And they put all their, you know, they put everything they had behind this record, you know.
I mean, and obviously it was the right choice to make, as we can now see historically. The sound, though, was also a thing. Like, it was, you know, the jump to the major, but it was also almost like a jump to the major label sound. And I don't mean that in a way that could have meant in the past, too. It was just a bigger sound that you guys made. Was that part of it? Did you say, okay, this is a bigger thing, let's go for the bigger sound? Like, what brought you all to that kind of sonic destination?
Yeah, we did use the time to sort of get things to
really hone.
We were very happy, so we weren't hurrying. The idea of not having to hurry, you know, there's a nice balance between having, at no point in Saturation did we really think, oh, we could be here for years, isn't this great? We still had, you know, a mission in mind, and we're cruising along as fast as we needed to, but sort of no faster, and that was a real luxury at the time.
Yeah, and you know, all our previous recordings, you know, they were more or less demos, because, you know, we'd have like, you know, the label, you know, had limited funds, like, you know, here's three or four stacks, go make a record within a week. So they're pretty much, you know, all those recordings, I mean, you know, there's some gems in there, but they were, for the most part, we didn't realize this till later, they were kind of like demos of songs, you know, because there was no time to polish or work out the material. You just had time to record it, and, you know, you just hope for the best. You know, when all of a sudden we were found ourselves in a situation where, you know, we had sort of unlimited resources, we were able to, you know, really hone the finished product. We didn't really know what a demo was until the label said, well, you know, we want to hear some demos. And we were like, what are you talking about? But we demoed like half the record. Half of it was still just sort of like loose ideas. But we demoed about half of it, maybe a little more. And we realized, listen to it, there were decent demos, but like, wow, this sounds just like all our other records on Touch and Go. So, you know, having that liberty to first demo and then, you know, hone the finished product was certainly new for us. And that's why it sounds like nothing we previously recorded, because everything before that was technically a demo of the final.
I was listening to Ty Segall talking on something about demoing, they demo stuff too. It's a good way to solidify. It just hasn't been something that we had done prior to that, I guess. Speaks for itself, right?
Well, and then, you know, so I'll jump ahead a little bit. You know, the album comes out, you know, and here's Sister Havana. And suddenly, well, I mean, you all had had several different styles that you were really great at, you know, even through those Touch and Go records. But, you know, because of that song, Pop Rock and Power Pop was suddenly at a peak, thanks to a song like that, you know, what Matthew Sweet happened to be doing at the same time. Did you ever feel like you were being pushed into a label that maybe you weren't exactly completely representative of?
I don't know. It was hard to say how people, you know, understood the band, but it's true. If anything, we definitely had been guilty of radical, you know, changes of personality from song to song, rather as well as from record to record. I think that's one thing that as Urge that has always been. We had gone on in so many directions. The stuff that we're known for or better known for is always just going to be sort of a random slice of the whole of like what Urge was trying to be about. But that was kind of the nature of our pursuit, was to not be able to stay with one direction or pursue like one sound ultimately too long. You know, we took a lot of left turns and reroutes, I think. But I guess that's all present on Saturation as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Could you find a weirder sonic palette? I think some of the, you know, the grit that you find that just really can't be faked was some demo material from the basement at the bank, the Urge subterranean lair, where we got, I guess we recorded Stalker. All that stuff is just straight from our demo, and with some work from the Butchers over the top, especially the vocals. But some of the darker textures on Saturation, I guess, were taken directly from the tapes where we were messing around with our first sort of demo studio. So some of the outtakes and some of the weirder stuff was recorded in Chicago here at the bank, I guess.
Lou Blum Midway Studios.
I'll bring up one of those tracks too, and I was going to ask about a couple of the tracks on the record, because speaking of different sounds, you know, you head down to a song like Dropout, which is one of my favorites on the record. The minimalism, you know, that happens in that song, I guess, in comparison to, you know, sounds that people might be more familiar with for Urge Overkill. What's the story behind that song? I've always kind of wanted to hear.
That, I think, came from what happens when you can sort of be working with a producer, like somebody who kind of has their own thing that they're good at. Joe was kind of having fun with this sampler stuff, building the
loops and shapes.
And he kind of, this thing had, I think, you know, he had this idea for the, I guess it was just kind of throwing something at another idea that took place. You know, I can't remember the genesis of Dropout, but that was written in the studio, right? We didn't have any kind of plan to have that song, right?
No. You know what I think what it was is that...
That was a pretty spontaneous deal.
Yeah. Well, I think what the situation, if I recall, the King and I were pretty busy. You know, we had to lay all the guitars and vocals, and we, you know, we had a full plate between ourselves. And you know, like most bands, you know, you get the drum tracks down first, and you just build up, you know, that foundation. So you know, Black had a lot of free time on his hands, and they had two studios. You know, the main, you know, Studio A and Studio B. So I mean, certainly unbeknownst to me. I think you had some involvement in it, but I didn't really know what they were cooking up in Studio B. That was, you know, I mean, we were pretty busy nonstop in Studio A. So they kept, you know, tooling around. Joe, the Butcher, he loved, they were one of the first to get it, you know, really get into loops and samples and things. So I think they just kept kind of tinkering with this project, this mystery project, that when it was, you know, in a sort of, you know, semi-finished state, I heard it and I loved it. It was, you know, it was was like nothing we'd ever done before, but, you know, there is something very seductive quality that song. It just kind of pulls you in, I think, because of the minimalism, like yeah. you say, Kyle. But yeah, so then I my only contribution was I just kept hearing this stupid little melody. They had this old, I found this old dusty, like, 80s synth in their closet. It had, like, an inch of dust on it. And I was like, what is this thing do? So I plugged it in, and so I just laid down the, that's about all I did was I laid down that, you know, the wang, 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 wang. You can hear me at this, at the top of the track kind of figuring out how it works. They kept that all in.
That's you learning, figuring out what the actual notes are at the beginning.
Right? Yes, yeah, exactly. And then there's no bass on it. I don't know if you noticed that, but well, this was kind of clever. They I don't know whose idea it was, but had me sing super low. You know, I've got a pretty low register, which I never really use with Urge. But so I'm singing as low as I can, just on the choruses, and that served as bass. They just kind of cranked it up. So there is a bottom to it. It's just not an electric bass guitar. It's a, wow. it's a vocal. You know? But yeah, I mean, I was as surprised and, you know, pleasantly surprised as everyone. You know, and this thing just emerged from Studio B.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it is a lot of people. I've heard it. We've heard a lot of people over the years say it's, you know, claim it's their favorite track. We, even the King and I, are looking at each other like, the drummer? Really? The drummer? Okay, I like it too.
Well, you know, with of course, we need to hit on the classic with Sister Havana. Was there a point when you noticed that that was happening? Like, oh, I think we've actually got something here, and it's reaching the masses in a way.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing we said when we dropped our gear in Philly at Studio 4 was, we said, well, you know, what do you guys want to do? They had heard the demos, and, you know, like, I think the first thing we blurted out was, because we knew we could, you know, like we never could before. We knew we were there for a few months. And we said, we want to sound like the radio. Make us sound like the radio, like radio friendly. You know, just super crush everything. And just because, you know, it's antithesis to everything we've done.
We're kind of like,
before.
We're kind of like, we dare you.
Right.
Yeah. It was almost like a dare.
Make it
yeah.
sound like, put us on the radio, we dare you.
Yeah, and you know, almost everything with Urge was always usually edited.
It was done with a smile and sort of as kind of a, you know, and a wink for sure. Because those guys
yeah.
knew, even though they were at the time known for doing their hip hop and stuff, they didn't, and we didn't really realize this, they were absolute recording and Beatles classic recording technique freaks at the time. And of course they had the board. They had the board to prove it. It was this Neve board that looked like it looked like a submarine. You know, he was, I remember when they were showing off about their board, he went and he stood on the board. He's like, you can't destroy this board. Phil was wearing those dumb white tennis shoes he wore. Remember that? He's like, I could stand on this fucking board. And I'm like, what are you doing? He's like standing on the knobs and the faders. He's like, you can't ruin this board.
Yeah.
You remember that
with
moment?
With the big oven knobs and, you know.
That happened, right? Maybe we have a Polaroid of that. We might.
Yeah. Thing was indestructible. It's a tank. But yeah, you know, I mean, like most things with those, they all find they're all rooted in some gag at the time, whatever we thought was kind of funny at the time. And yeah, so, you know, our, like, make us sound like classic rock radio. It was, you know, it was sort of a dare, but based on a gag, like, wouldn't it be funny if, you know, because we can. And like Ed said, we had no idea that they were so versed and all, you know, they were both, you know, George Martin, Beatle freaks. And they knew all the old tricks. They had the old board to pull it off, and so that's what they did.
They
file that under, you know, careful what you wish for.
But they knew all about, like, of course we had our own ideas and did our own things, but they knew a lot about how actual, like, a lot of background vocals were actually done and how you get it to work with everything else and things like that, where they were as excited to try things out with some, like, three-part harmonies and whatnot, that they were as excited as we were in terms of, you know, wanting to to sort of go down certain alleyways that maybe take a little longer, that you would never tell a rock band to do.
Right.
Usually producers are like, move on, boys. And so we didn't expect that, I guess. But certainly when there was time to leave it alone in terms of putting too much instrumentation on a record. I don't think Saturation has that either. So in that, they were helpful too.
Or too much gloss. I mean, to their credit, the Butchers were always adamant about maintaining what they dubbed the Urge Charm, which we, you know, hated, but the Urge Charm referred to all our, you know, rather squishy, demo-y previous recordings. We wanted to just do something, you know, really opposite of that. But they were always very careful to, you know, it became very addictive. Like, let's make everything perfect and, you know, super sheeny and, you know, and sound like $1 million. And they were always step in every now and then, stop us from, you know, over burnishing everything, you know, and saying, you know, that you got it. That's the Urge Charm. You know, that's part of your appeal. You can't erase all the Urge Charm. Yeah. You know, the slightly jangly or out of tune kind of things. We got carried away. We were this close to, you know, making a Def Leppard's Pyromania or something.
That's true. I remember we were trying to, like, re-record Stalker, right? We're in there like...
Yeah.
And, you know, we're pounding...
Yeah, we could not reproduce it.
Pounding our fucking heads just like, guys, you want to come in here? And they play the demo. And then they play what we just did. It ain't working.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, thank God.
But, I mean, they get full credit for, you know, the so-called Urge Charm, maintaining the Urge Charm on the record.
Well, so that happens, and you all end up on two of the biggest tours of the year. I mean, from what I read, you ended up on the Nevermind tour with Nirvana and the Versus tour with Pearl Jam, which, you know, and we're talking about, you know, the height of all of this stuff. What was that like to be in that kind of scene? Other than, I know on tour, most of the time you're just in a green room, kind of oblivious to whatever's happening on the outside. But was there any sense that this thing was a behemoth all across the world, this whole movement?
It really was a crazy feeling, because if you had to be there to realize, at least with both of these experiences, I guess with Nirvana, it was weird because we happened to be on the road with them as their record went from maybe it'll be another Sonic Youth. Like, that's the best. Everybody's biggest hope at Geffen was that, you know, maybe if this gets these guys on the level of Sonic Youth, oh boy, that would be great. And then this whole different thing happens, which is like, you know, there's like little Metallica fans like getting into the shows, and kids who are there, they don't even know why they're at the show. Like, you sort of see some of the why it's scary when you get huge overnight, where all of a sudden there's these audiences. Yeah, they were massive, but the band are like saying, who are these? These aren't like our people, or, you know,
yeah, they,
who are these people?
They were as dumbfounded as we were. We just found ourselves in the, you know, in the vortex of this, you know, this, you know, I mean, it started in the States, did a couple of weeks of them in the States. You know, our first gig with them, we'd never met them before. I don't think we knew much about them. But, you know, they showed up in a van and a trailer. We showed up in a van and a trailer. And by the second or third show on the tour, the shows were getting bumped up to these larger venues. And, you know, I mean, it's just like being caught up in a whirlwind. It just all was happening so fast. And you know, and all you could do was kind of hang on, you know, and enjoy the ride. And by the time we toured with them in Europe, you know, they had knocked Michael Jackson out of the number one spot. You know, it just exploded globally.
It was like they were 20 times bigger than, like, the hugest you thought you could get when we left the tour with them in the U.S. Remember that fall? The record came out.
Yeah.
And then they sort of thought that Come As You Are was going to be the big hit, the second song. Mm-hmm. But when Teen Spirit hit, I mean, they totally weren't ready for that to be, like, an international hit.
No,
so it was
particularly Curry.
Really,
particularly,
it was really
not what he signed up for. You know, when he picked up a guitar.
Yeah.
So that
the whole world.
But it was the beginning of a time, I guess. Before that, you know, Michael Jackson was number one, and we were in a certain period of music. And by the time, you know, Nirvana really hit big, which kind of changed. That simultaneously, Pearl Jam had been, like, when we ended up on tour with them, they sort of had been and were, like, the biggest band in terms of fan-wise in the whole world, I think. You know, it was really this time when, you know, rock bands never, since then, have never been held in that kind of esteem, where it's like, they were like the mightiest thing going. And then there's a certain like confidence that you play with that when everybody is 100,000% behind you. The band, we were witness to actually some shows that really were fantastic because of, you know, how on top of the world they were at the time, I guess. Wouldn't you say that?
Yeah, but I mean, it all happened so fast. I mean, you know, for them and certainly for us, I mean, we'd never played to thousands of kids before. You know, we rocked every, you know, punk rock shithole in the country, but... it was a real crash course. And I think for them as well, you know, they were on the same circuit we were for years. And so, yeah, it was certainly a learning experience. And
yeah.
Just to get used to.
You know,
by the time, you know, we hit with Pearl Jam, we never thought we'd be on a coach touring, but it was just logistically, I mean, we had no choice to keep up with them. You know, that's when we stepped on, you know, first step onto a coach.
If we were going to tour with them, they said, yeah, well, it's not logistic. Yeah. So that's yeah. how we kind of got into getting
right.
on.
But
we usually didn't have, but it really is the way to go because you can sleep, you know, you don't have to wake up in the morning. So, yeah.
That was another crash course because those shows were even bigger. I mean, Nirvana was as big, but we weren't, you know.
Right.
By the time they got to that size, we weren't with them. But,
it
I mean,
like
they were
football.
Playing, you know. Like
it was football stadiums.
Yeah.
You
hockey
get,
stadiums and shit. Yeah.
And in Oklahoma, in Anywheresville, Pearl Jam could play the biggest place around for miles.
Right.
No problem.
Yeah.
And it would have been the biggest thing. And it was the biggest thing that ever happened there. I mean, we saw really crazy stuff, and people were blowing out all the stops. Like the people in Oklahoma had lobster flown in. Like they had this really sort of touching way of showing Pearl Jam how much class they had in Oklahoma City. They flew out the night. The biggest like lobsters you can get were like sitting there, and somebody had obviously catered this, like was really proud of this thing that they set out. And the band, you know, could fucking care less what, you know, Oak City has got or what anybody has left for them. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. They're on a whole nother trip. So it was really kind of a weird thing seeing shit you never thought you'd see. They were actually just kind of jaded at the time and were sort of like, what the fuck? This was so, I mean, they were in the twilight zone too from being so huge, you know, right? There was some bizarre activity going on. I remember from the Butthole Surfers was around. Various other characters were hanging around. It was quite a scene.
Right. But it was also strange for us, both for Nirvana and Pearl Jam, that here we had this record that it certainly came with, you know, full potential for radio play. And, you know, like I said, Geffen put all their big guns behind it. But, you know, no one has a crystal ball. And both Nirvana and Pearl Jam hailing from Seattle, this new grunge explosion that the media was on, you know, you couldn't find a more antithetical album than Saturation, you know, to this grunge explosion. I mean, you know, they were all fans of the band, but, you know, these kids, like Ed said, you know, to half of them don't even know why they're there. They just know they have to be there. You know, so they're there and they're, you know, ripped up flannels and whatnot, you know, waiting for, you know, for this grunge explosion. And
we really didn't.
Guys,
we didn't get much.
Jumping around in velvet suits singing about cars and girls. And, you know, I mean, they were as dumbfounded as we were, but, you know, we held tough.
I learned about a lot of great bands because of their opening acts. Like that was always a thing. Like I would look to see the opening acts, especially of Pearl Jam and Nirvana to a large point too, to introduce me to things that I hadn't heard about. And you know, Urge Overkill was definitely one of those. It was a nice way.
Well, that was the tradition, which kind of now that everybody is booked by the same people and the, you know, there's totally different deals going on with concerts. It used to be that the headlining band always got to do whatever the fuck they wanted to do with choosing a, they could choose whoever they wanted to as an opener, as a statement of taste, and to help a band out that they wanted to, was a huge tradition in our, you know, where we were coming up in the shows that we played. And that's, I guess, something that doesn't happen in the same way anymore, I guess. That was cool.
The bands
really did get to make those decisions back in the day.
Yeah, I mean, Kurt was always pushing the Melvins and a lot of his favorite bands. That, you know, he was the first to pull them up and do what he could to them. And, you know, and Pearl Jam, remember, like in Chicago, I remember they had that show we opened for Pearl Jam, but the first band was, I don't know if you remember a band called The Frogs.
Oh, yeah.
Milwaukee. But, you know, I was like, that's how Pearl Jam. They're like, you know, fuck it. We don't care. We love this band.
That's how I learned about
them.
They're
on the bill.
Yeah. Right, yeah. So,
there's
some of the fans were not as happy.
Yeah, there's another track that came out around that time. It was on the No Alternative compilation, which to me, I'll still hear people talk about that. There was a couple compilations from that era that just became classic albums in themselves. You all submitted the song Take a Walk for that one. Do you remember much about that one? Because that's sort of claimed its own classic status because of the record.
You know, we wrapped up the Saturation session. Went back to Chicago, and then that No Alternative thing came up, and you're like, well, you know, I think we still had gear there too, you know. So we just went, you know, we said, fuck it, let's just go back to Philly, you know, because we were on a roll with this guy, you know, we had a good, you know, we knew them, they knew us, and so it was very easy for us to step on a plane and go back to Philly for, you know, I think it was like a 24-hour period, and we cranked that out. It was called View of the Rain, but I guess the butcher, he didn't know that, and they needed a title when he sent it in, so he put Take a Walk. But, you know, the track turned out, you know, better than we thought. We thought, you know, when someone asks you to do a track for a compilation, we just finished this record, so obviously we're not going to put anything on that. So, you know, I don't recall the genesis of that tune, but...
We didn't really have anything, but the thing was, we didn't do much, but kind of play the song that kind of had this, I mean, you can really hear that studio, the type of sound that you get from like their board and their tape saturation and things like that comes across, I think, on that song. What is so cool, I mean, and then we were at liberty to get some string players, which we hadn't done before, which was just kind of a casual thing, but that sort of added so much.
It kind of wrote and arranged itself, and we were in and out of there. And
yeah,
and,
that was like a quick weekend, right?
Then we decided, because people loved it so much, so we decided to include it on the Saturation follow-up, the Exit Dragon, with its proper title, View of the Rain. So
we'll wrap up here, obviously, heading back to the present. I know it's been a few years now, right, since the last full length. Do you guys, are you planning anything else? Do you want to do another album at this point? You know, I see tour dates happening, so is there any new musical creations that come along with that?
Yes, there's the vaults, as it were, always have some interesting secrets. But we are, at the moment, have had plans for a release, which I don't want to say too much about at this time. But so we've got new music. We're still playing, and we're certainly, I guess, going to have some things coming up that go along with, even though we're not playing on the anniversary of the Saturation record. The fact is the vinyl has been out of print because of the way Geffen has been bought and sold a few times since we were active on the label. But there is a license that's, Ness, do you remember the name of the company, Plowshares Records? They licensed it, and so it's going to be available in the vinyl, in the original color and everything like that.
Awesome.
Very soon, the Saturation LP. So that has just been, we were looking into licensing it ourselves, and a guy that we already know had just got, you know, he had just done a deal to license it, so we're looking forward to that.
Awesome.
And we have a new album in the can. We just finished mixing and mastering it, so I don't know exactly when that'll drop, but it's pretty much done. kind of, we're all scattered now about the country, so it's not like the old days where we could just all, you know, live in a studio for a month or so, but right. we chipped away at it for the last couple of years.
Indeed, but we always had a good time in Louisville. Louisville was one of the first places we ever played, I ever toured out of town with.
Well, that's awesome.
We were on tour with Big Black, their maybe first tour ever in a van. They used to fly to gigs, but do you remember that?
Yeah, that was our first road experiences. Yeah, I don't know why it was Louisville and Lexington all around there, but that's where the shows were, and a couple in Ohio, I think. But yeah, we always loved Louisville.
Yeah, hopefully we'll make it back to Louisville before too long.
Yeah, we'd love to see you over here. Really would.
Well, thanks for the the knowledgeable questions about saturation and all that. It was a pleasure to discuss it. And, give us a call. And,
yeah, a record recorded a million years ago, yet seems like yesterday.
Happy 25th anniversary to a classic, to being part of something, an honest-to-goodness classic in the whole rock catalog. That's it's not easy, and everybody doesn't get it. And that's definitely, one that's stamped for history right there.
Thanks again.
All right. Nice, it's a pleasure talking to you both. I really appreciate it. And we'll see you around.
Thanks, Kyle.
All right, Kyle. Thanks again. Yeah. Enjoy your weekend.
You too. Take care. Bye.
All right. Cheers.
My thanks to Nash, Cato, and the King for that call right there, celebrating Urge Overkill's 25th anniversary of Saturation. Don't forget, you can subscribe to Consequence of Sound's YouTube channel. If that's where you're listening from right now, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to the podcast version, you can subscribe there as well. iTunes, Podchaser, go ahead and give a rating, leave a review. I would be really, really grateful. Then you can head over to wfpk.org. That's where I do a show every Monday through Thursday from noon to 3 Eastern. You'll also find some bonus episodes of this series over there as well. I'm Kyle Meredith, and I'll see you next time.
Consequence Podcast Network.